build a system in a laboratory, and we're going to build atoms. So we don't have to put extra atoms in there and additional gates and stuff like that. One atom is going to take one qubit, and it's going to operate in a very different manner than you would expect on a D-Wave machine. But before I did that, I wanted to go through, and I realized that doing a primer here is really essential. And so what I was going to do is go through this, and I don't know if I'm going to get the whole thing. It's kind of short. I've got about 30 slides, but I want to go through it, post it, and then we're going to set the actual ion trap. It will be two lectures on the 13th and the 15th. This way you'll have a chance to digest all this material, and then when I go pull out the idea of building an ion trap, you'll say, oh, yeah, that's the reason we're going to put that. Okay, so the goal is to study the ion trap. This is what it looks like. It's very different from a D-Wave machine. This happens to be one that's at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. You'll notice there's an optical bench here. There are millions of different lenses, and there's a cryostat in here, and so it looks very different than the D-Wave machine. So basically, there's four things that the ion trap needs. It needs charged atomic particles. It needs electromagnetic fields, it needs lasers, and it needs a low temperature experimental chamber in which to do this whole experiment. And so what I'm going to do is walk you through each one of these things and explain to you why each one of them is absolutely unique and absolutely essential in terms of building an ion trap. And what I'll do is I'll do the TIQC is trapped ion quantum computer in there. Okay, so first thing, instead of using D-Wave things, we're actually going to go pull atoms, okay? And if you go back to your high school chemistry class, you'll find that the atom has a bunch of protons and neutrons in here, and then what happens is the electrons fill around this nucleus of each atom, and there are equal number of electrons with protons, so the overall atom is neutral. So everything here is neutral. You don't get shocked when you touch any sort of material. It's a neutral thing. So what happens is, in general, that's the way an atom will, in general, be put together. And there's lots to choose from. And this is the periodic table. I'm sure you've all seen this way back in chemistry days. And it lists basically every single element that we have so far found on Earth naturally, plus a number that we've actually constructed through nuclear interactions and actually forcing decay of heavy elements. But nevertheless, there's a large plethora of things to choose from. So now the question is, which one of them, or which group of them, should we choose to put into an ion trap? Remember, we're going to put atoms in the ion trap. So you have to have some sort of a judicious understanding of why you pick one atom versus another. Okay? So in order to do that, we need to go look at a little bit of the way things are constructed in this universe. And that has to do with the way an atom is built. If you look here, go back up to the chart, you'll see this has a number 1. Over here is the number 2 on helium. And then lithium is 3, and 4 is beryllium, 5 is boron, and 6 is carbon. That has the number has to do with the number of protons that are associated with each particular type of an element. And you'll notice the chart has a kind of a funny little asymmetry to it. And that's because that the way the electrons are loaded into the shells is governed by the laws of quantum mechanics. And so not every electron is loaded into the exact same shell. It turns out they load them in various ways. And in general, they are classified in terms of states. And there's an S state, and that takes 2 electrons. A P state will take 6. A D state will take 10. And for each one of these states, there are various different energy levels. You start off with N equals 1, N equals 2, N equals 3. And so if you draw a diagram of that, it looks like this is a generic little template of exactly any sort of atom you have. Each one of these can take 2 electrons. So if you have a 1s state, you have 1 up, electron, one down, one spin down electron. You'll notice that as you go up in energy, the states get higher. You go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. But they don't get higher sequentially. You'll notice this is 1s, then 2s, then you go over to 2p, then 3s, then 3p. You don't go to 3d, you go to 4s, and then you go to 3d. So there's a bit of a jog back and forth. And what you want to do is you want to find an atom. You want to pick an element such that a lot of these electron shells are filled. And the parts that are unfilled are a small number that you can control. And so each electron that's in an unfilled shell end up being related to a qubit. And so by judiciously picking the right element, you can control the number of these electrons that are flying around out here, and then you can make a judicious choice. So I am going to kind of jump ahead, and one of them that is used in an ion trap is the calcium atom. Okay, the calcium atom has 20 protons, and it has 20 electrons running around inside it, and a varying number of neutrons, which are kind of irrelevant for this discussion. And so if one was to go load in the number of electrons just in the way it was loaded in, you've got two here, six in P, two in 3S, six in 3P, and then 4S. So you have 2, 4, 10, 12, 18, 20. So what happens is every one of these, remember there was two for an S shell, six for a P shell, every one of these here is a filled shell, except the very last shell. So what happens is, this is a candidate type of element. It turns out this is not the only one. If I was to go back here, calcium sits here, in there. And if you look in the second column of the periodic table, there are a number of other choices. You can do beryllium, you can do barium. There are other types of choices in here. You can do cadmium, and mercury, and rubidium down here. So there are various different ones you can pick. Why pick calcium versus another one? It's purely the experimentalist choice. And the reason is because the way the calcium is constructed, it will actually have various energy levels that are easier to detect in an experiment than by picking calcium than by picking some other atom. Okay, so what's the next thing? So we now know we're going to narrow down the type of atom we want to pick. And I'm not talking about the ion trap. I'm just talking about the parts that we have to go, the Lego blocks that we have to put together. The second Lego block that has to go in here has to do with the idea of electromagnetic fields. And what happens is, if I was to have, for example, an electron sitting here, how do I get this electron to go up to another higher energy level? I need to do something. I need to kick it. I need to give it energy. And it turns out the electromagnetic waves, electromagnetic fields, do exactly that. They provide the drivers. They do two things. The electromagnetic fields carry energy. They also carry orbital length. They also carry angular momentum. And so if you're an electron sitting here and you see this electromagnetic wave coming at you, when it hits you, there can be a transfer of energy from where the electron is. There's also a transfer of angular momentum. And so I have a little cartoon here. And if you look at that, what you see, the way an electromagnetic field works, there's an electric field and a magnetic field, and they totally oscillate against each other such that over time, one electric field grows and pulls the magnetic field down and back and forth. And if you look at this green arrow, that is the vector sum of the electric and magnetic field. So if I'm an electron and I'm looking at this thing coming down right at me, I'm not only going to see a bunch of energy, I'm also going to see an angular momentum. So if I'm sitting here and this thing hits me, I'm going to be twisted. I'm going to be kicked. Okay? What has that got? Let me refer that back to Quirk. when you built the gates, remember there were quarter gates and eighth gates and 16th gates? That's one way to do it. When you deal with it with an electromagnetic field, you can change the time, you can change the phase, you can change the length of the pulse in which it hits. Therefore, you can change the kick and the amount of angle that goes into that particular electron that gets hit. So the electromagnetic field is a nice little device. It's a nice little device because it carries a phase, it carries all sorts of information about energy, it can carry angular momentum. It essentially drives the system. And we need that when we're going to build an ion trap. Okay. Questions? Am I going too fast? Some of you have quantum patterns, you know it already. So if you don't, I want to make sure you're not getting lost, because I know if you're in computer science, you're not taking this stuff. So basically, we've got to pick an element, we've got to pick something that makes sense, and we've got to have something to drive it. So the element is there, the electromagnetic field is what's actually driving it. Okay? So the question then becomes, can I just take a flashlight, and can I just take a flashlight and put it on these calcium atoms and have them do what I want them to do? And the answer is, no, not really, not very efficiently. And so what I have to do is I have to find some sort of a mechanism that will essentially kick an electron from one state to another, or have it transition down from one state to another. And so in quantum mechanics, you have these very discrete states. They're not continuous. There's very discrete states. And there's a very discrete energy difference between these states. Very, very, very specific. So in other words, if the electron is sitting here, and it sees an energy that's 2.6 times what it's supposed to get, it might not work, or if it's only half of what it's supposed to get. It needs to get an energy exactly the amount here. The second thing is that we need to see is that if you look at these states, there's S and P and D. And so what happened is, if you go draw the calcium as a specific element, what you find is this is the actual structure of the calcium ion, and this is the drawing line, this is the 4s2. Everything is filled up to here. The 20 electrons are in here. All these states are filled. This thing is just sitting here. So if I shine an electromagnetic wave on this thing, I can kick something which is sitting in a very nicely in a bound state, kick it up into an excited state. But I have to kick it according to a very, very specific wavelength. And so therefore, I don't necessarily just want any sort of electromagnetic wave. I want one that I can really tune and tweak. And so that's really talking about the concept of a laser. And so when you, yes?
So I'm kind of with you, right? So, but am I trying to choose a particular, an electron at a particular level to move to a particular other level?
Yes, definitely. Okay. Definitely.
So how do I know that I'm moving something that's in the 4s as opposed to moving something that's in the 3s?
Because of the fact that there's a certain amount of energy that needs to be done. So you know that this thing needs exactly 397 nanometers, which is a certain wavelength, which corresponds to a certain frequency, which corresponds to a certain energy, E equals H nu. Okay? So therefore, I can tune. That's why the experimentalists pick the atoms they do. You asked me this question earlier. Why do they pick them? They want their life to be easy. I could go pick a different element where it's all ultraviolet transitions. It's really hard to deal with. Much easier to deal with a visible laser that has a very specific frequent tunable laser that I can just tune and literally tweak it exactly where I need it and make it jump up and down.
So what's the chance that I energize two electrons and they actually split?
That has to do with part four. We'll get to that. Okay. Why do I want a low temperature experimental apparatus?
Okay.
I want a low temperature experimental apparatus, to answer your question quickly. I want to make sure. Because what happens is you want to cool things down. Because when they're room temperature, everything is fluctuating and noisy. But when I cool it almost to absolute zero, everything is quiet. Okay. And so therefore, what I can do is I can kick one transition and I can control things better. That's why quantum computers need such low temperatures in order to operate. Okay. So we now know we can build a laser, we can hit these energy states, okay, and we'll go back up here, and we can begin to control things. We get the phase, we get the amount of light. There's one other thing that we need to do that's part of a laser, and I'll show you that here. Let me jump a little bit ahead. If you look at just a regular light, it's incoherent. There's all different frequencies in here. So what one really wants to do is one really wants a laser because it's a coherent beam of light which has a very unique wavelength, and I can actually decide how long I want that pulse to go. Let's say if I want this thing to go one period, it's there. If I only wanted pi, if I only wanted half a period, I chop the pulse off over here, or a quarter period. And so I can essentially build those gates by simply deciding the length of time of the pulse. And that changes the phase, it can change the coherence. This thing guarantees that that laser is zeroed in on one transition. Okay, there's one other thing we need to be careful about. And if you go back here, you'll see there's all different sorts of states. There's an S state, a P state, a D state, and everything. And so in quantum mechanics, the electrons have a bunch of rules they have to obey. And they just don't go randomly jump from one state to another. At least they don't do it easily. And so one of the things is called a selection rules. In other words, if you have an electron, it tends to want to change its state by one unit of orbital angular momentum. So S has a zero orbital momentum, P has a one state, D has a two state. So it's very much easier for an electron to jump from an S state to a P state. That's called an allowed transition. And the time it takes to do that transition is on the order of nanoseconds. So it's about 10 nanoseconds. That's the lifetime in which the electron lives in its excited state before it takes the energy. It doesn't like being unstable and radiates it away and goes back down. I don't necessarily have to have a transition to an allowed state. If I was to build my laser and put enough power in there, I could kick this electron from an S state to a D state. That's called a forbidden transition. Because now you've got two units of angular momentum, and there's no easy way for that electron to get rid of that unit of angular momentum. And so what happens is it tends to be long-lived. Long-lived in terms of ion trap computers is about a second. That's a life, that's forever, in terms of actually constructing a system. Because in one sense, you have allowed transitions operating on 10 to the minus 9th seconds. And in another sense, you've got a state, and you put it into a stable situation where it sits there for a second. So if I'm looking to build a qubit and kick that qubit into a state where it doesn't decay and doesn't get damaged and doesn't have any decoherence, I'd like to get it kicked into a forbidden transition. And there are a bunch of rules, and I'm not going to go over them all with you. I'm just going to put this in as a reference. There are electric dipole transitions, magnetic dipole transitions, and quadrupole transitions. That a forbidden transition, for example, would be an electric quadrupole. So I have both allowed states that I want, and I have forbidden states. I've got the type of material that I need, and I've got a driver which will provide the energy and the angular momentum to drive this system. And now I have a construct to be able to put together these states in such a way that I can hook them so that I can make a long-lived state, and I can make a short-lived state, and I can couple the two of them together. So I'm starting to build what can be argued to be, maybe I'm putting together qubits or gates, and maybe that's, we're getting sort of close to where it goes. Okay, so this has to do with the fact, the reason you want to have a laser is you can literally dial up the energy, you can dial up the phase, you can dial up the length of time you use to kick the state. I think this is just that I just repeated this thing. This is another diagram. So you'll see that each one of these, I can decide if I was to tune the laser to 397 nanometers, I'd get a transition to here. If I was to tune it here to 729 nanometers, I'd get a jump into here. Okay, so by doing this, I can literally dial up a configuration just the way I'd want to see it. Okay. Now, to get back to your question, why do you want to, why don't you want to have lots and lots of states? And that is, you want to cool the thing down to absolute zero, so that you don't end up with lots of noise in the system. So if you have one system, one electron, it kicks and jumps into one-sided state and doesn't roll around. And so therefore, you want to have essentially a very cold experimental apparatus, or a very cold doer, in which you put the material and you actually do the excitations. So if we look at this as a whiteboard, just a white piece of paper, and we look at that, these are the states we're working with, all right? And it's quiet, it's cold. So these are all empty, okay? And below it is all filled. And so what I want to do, by simply tuning something, I'm hitting something here, I can just jump from an S state to a P state. But I can also, it'll also jump from an S state to a D state. So in other words, I get unwanted volunteers, even when it's really cold, to jump various different types of transitions. So one laser isn't going to do it. One laser isn't going to suggest, is there more than one laser in a trapped ion computer? And yes, there is. There's five different ones. And there are five different ones because each one of these lasers has a very specific purpose. And they have a very specific frequency that they have to deal with. And so depending on where you are in constructing this, you'll probably have one laser to start the ground state to an excited state. And this will be to kick the ground state to the excited state for the qubit. All right? But in doing that, here, I also pollute it by going from this 5 halves to 3 halves, and I have to drain this thing. I have a 5 halves to, I'm going to a P1 half. So I need other lasers to drain the other excess, the unwanted states, and get them to all depopulate down. So at the end of the day, all I'm left with is this stable qubit here. And so therefore, by doing that, I essentially have limited the Hilbert space. I've limited the number of states I can actually deal with. And this is kind of just a write-up that I did in terms of how do you get rid of the unwanted volunteers. You have to get rid of them by actually putting different lasers at different wavelengths and hit the states to essentially flush them out. You flush them out and drain them. So at the end of the day, all you've got is your one state here is what you really want, is this 1/2 to 5/2 state. Once I have that and I have it cleanly done, I essentially have a stable qubit running.
So why do the others get populated?
Because they totally allow transitions. I mean, you can have, for example, a D state. If I kick it from the 1/2 to the 5/2 state, it can transition down to a 3/2 state. Mm-hmm. So I'm forcing it from an S to a D. But because of the fact that I have lots of other, when you have a complex atom, you have other unpopulated states, there's nothing to force that thing to say, you have to stay as a 5-half state. I can take it down from the, that thing can decide, I don't want to go down to an S state, I'll just go down to a 3/2 state.
Yeah, so I can tune to get a particular excitation to a particular level. It could decay into vacant states below it.
Yes.
But you're not going to get anything higher than
correct.
When you tune the laser.
And
excited, but you're assuming that we can neglect thermal excitation.
Right, but when it's decaying into allowed states, it's much faster. So some of the stuff will stay living there for 1 second. The stuff that decays down in a allowed state will sit down and, decay down in a much faster time. And to help get that thing, you want to flush the thing out, you just send another laser pulse in there to get any of the extra unwanted volunteer states that come in there to just flush them out. So the only thing you're left with is the electron that's sitting in the D5-F state. We don't know where to go. All the other stuff is decaying.
Is that a matter of choice? Can I have like any other P-like level?
You can choose whatever you want, but but that has to do with the material you pick. You know, if you because not only do you have to deal with the L sub Z, you have the Z component and the spurting element in there. So there's really two components in there. So if you make your life miserable until higher states, you have more Z components. You don't want to have that. You want to have the minimum number of components that you can to have it go through. Okay? So if we were to go towards thinking about this, and I got 2 minutes to go, and I want to let you go. In other words, if we were to have a quantum computer, and we wanted to have a single two-level system interacting with an electromagnetic field, we want to be able to control that by rotating the spin, the equivalent of the simple gates that I did when you change the Pauli spin matrices, and you want the thing to be confined. You don't want the thing wandering all over the place, and I'll talk about the experimental thing of how you actually build that. But in other words, what happens is you will pick a state up into a high place where the electron is stuck as a qubit, and then what happens is you line up all the atoms here, and each atom has its own qubit state, and what happens is by cooling it down, you can line them up in a row, just like a slinky spring. And the slinky spring will then have certain motion, and that will interact with a qubit up in the excited state, which lives for a long time, which has a different motion. And so you essentially have two qubit states. And by actually doing transitions and changes in phases and rotations and electromagnetic pulses, you can essentially build the equivalent of basic quantum gates. And by using the lasers will tell you the order in which things are done. And so at the end of the sequence of things that you do on the ion track, you can then go take a measurement in terms of how the thing is going. So that's the next two lectures. That's the 13th and the 15th. But basically, there's a couple of things that are different. Number one, this is very different from a D-wave. This actually is using physical pieces of matter, and we're actually using the principles of quantum mechanics to actually construct up qubit states. And each one is a state in itself. I don't have to add extra atoms in there that don't necessarily perform, or they have to, redundant states. Every one of them actually functions as part of the qubit. So I need electromagnetic fields to be the drivers, and low temperatures to make sure that this thing's quiescent, and I can only use one. I can choose to pick what I want to pick, and I need some sort of a laser, an electromagnetic field, to make this thing work. And so by doing these four types of things, I can actually construct states, which we've been discussing, but it's a very different way to approach a quantum computer than it would be, for example, D-Wave. They're equally good, but it's just different. And so in terms of building it.
So just a quick question. So in the d-orbital, the way you go to other states, like in the d-orbital, is by way of block polarization. You play with the polarization of the wave, and
you
then
play,
it changes
you play the phase of the laser,
And then it could put the electron in the...
Sure, it'll kick it, give a certain orbital, it'll give you a certain angular momentum, and therefore you give it a certain energy, mm-hmm. and so therefore you know that you essentially kept a complex phase. You essentially give it a phase different out of it from the other phase.
And then it will go to
the and then by hitting the lasers in certain order, you can find out how these qubits will interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And you essentially write out a quantum program. You write out those basic gates. What are the basic gates? I twist it this way. I give it a certain energy here. I actually excite the state up here. I kick the qubit. I move it down. And by actually doing these types of programming, you can actually get the thing to go through all possible quantum mechanical states and come up with the probability when you finish the experiment. So the final thing is to actually shoot one laser, and the final thing, for example, where I would find here, it would be the last slide, if I hit this thing at a certain state, if this thing is in a ground state, it won't oscillate. If it's in an excited state, I will be able to transition this thing down. So depending on where the electrons finally end up, I can make the measurement. And I don't disturb the system in the course of doing all the measurements, so I don't have a decoherence in there. I only make one measurement in there, and that's at the end. I'm going to put these slides up here. We're going to go through, I'm going to spend 2 days, two lectures, really building this thing. But for those of you who don't know quantum mechanics or atomic physics, that's basically cherry-picking basic stuff. You need a material. The material has to have properties. Electromagnetic fields drive the system. They give it energy. They give it angular momentum. Translate that. They give it rotations and gates. You can make things stable for long periods of time, or you can make them transition very quickly, and you need a low temperature, so you have this, you limit the number of possible options you can have. And those are the building blocks, and with that, we'll start on the 13th, and we'll actually start to put together the thing of how do you build an ion trap quantum computer.
Right. Well,
so I know that's a mouthful, and it was a race through, but I'm happy to answer questions, or send an email. I'll send this thing to Frank. He'll post the slides, and you can go over them. But I thought this was useful before I start building the thing, because otherwise no one would understand, have any idea why I'm drawing lines where I'm drawing them, and why states look the way they are.
Great, thanks.
Okay.
Next time we're going to have Travis Humble from Oak Ridge via Hangout, and he's going to talk about systems and software for quantum computing. I do have the other room reserved, so we are going there. We're going to claim that room finally. I hope there's not going to be another conflict with it, but I think not.